One more time, Sid Bream. Come on, ladies and gentlemen. Well, not ladies, just gentlemen. You guys have a seat.
Good morning, gentlemen. They like this so much, they want me to throw out some more baseballs. So, as they do at ballparks, let me hear you down here. Do you want a baseball? What about it? Here, 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 here. How about it up there? Don't miss. Here we go, guys. Nice job. Don't anybody get hit in the head. Oh, there's the first one. Right here in the front. What do I hear? Oh, there's another one. That's an error. Oh, that's a terrible throw. I got one more. Right down there. Oh, get there. That a boy. Nice job, guys. Now my arm, I need some ice. I'm so thankful that you guys were willing to come back this morning and after you heard us all last night and be a part of this morning. But let me just share with you, last night I just talked to you about, you know, that God gave me a platform to be up here and speak because of that one slide. But there were other things. I mean, I played 10 years in the major leagues with the Dodgers, Pirates, Braves and Astros. Just a couple other things that, were highlights of my career. My first hit came as a Dodger back in September of 1983. And Mike Marshall was on third base. I had an opportunity as a pinch hitter to come up. Tommy Lasorda said, get up and get your bat. And, understanding that I was playing with guys like Steve Yeager and Rick Mundy and Billy Russell and Davey Lopes, and a lot of you young people don't know those names, but they were phenomenal. It was a phenomenal team back then. And he told me, he said, Sid, get your bat. Mike Marshall was on third base. We were losing 1-0. There were two outs in the inning. And Vin Scully is up there announcing the event. And Tom Hume from the Cincinnati Reds came up and threw me an inside fastball, and I hit a line drive over to second baseman's head. I got a standing ovation. I got a standing ovation. I have Vin Scully's cassette tape at home. I don't know if I can even play it anymore. But I got Vin Scully, announcing, and just saying, listen to the crowd. It was a phenomenal time for me as a young man, getting my first hit in the major leagues. My first home run came in 1985 against Mike Kruko in the LA Stadium. And then in 1985, I had the first opportunity. The regular first baseman for the Dodgers was hurt. So I started the year with the LA Dodgers in 1985. And the first person that I had to face that year in the Houston Astrodome was no other than Nolan Ryan. That was my first at bat. And I want you to know something. I got a hit off of him. I hit a line drive to left field, scored Mike Marshall again from second base, and that's the way my 1985 season started. And I thought, if I can beat Mike, hit Nolan Ryan, there ain't nobody else that I can't hit. And so I went through that season, then I got traded. But, one of the fondest memories for me was, I came down to Atlanta, but at the same time, when I was in Pittsburgh, we lost in 1990 to the Cincinnati Reds in the playoffs. The very next day, the Pittsburgh Pirates came out and said, Sid Bream's our first priority to sign for the 1991 season. So we were happy. My wife and I were thinking, man, we're going to get a several-year deal. We're here with our friends and so on and so forth. Went through the negotiation process. They didn't even get close to market price on me. Atlanta gave me a great offer. When it came to free agency time, but said they needed to have a decision by this time that night, because otherwise they were going someplace else. And so we said yes. But all that night, as we went to bed, my wife and I cried all night long thinking we were leaving Pittsburgh. The next morning I woke up and I called Jim Leland, my manager, and I said, Skip, I said, am I bound to this contract? And he said, you haven't put your name on it, you're not bound to it. So I got on the phone for an hour and a half talking to my attorney, and he was trying to talk me out of doing what I was going to do in staying with Pittsburgh and taking the money that they were going to give me. But for all that time, I mean, as he was talking, he finally got to the place, he said, well, what happens if they sign you and then they trade you to Atlanta? You're going to look like an idiot. I said, great point. So we went back to the Pittsburgh Pirates and said, if you'll give us a no-trade clause, we'll go ahead and stay with you. And they said, no, we're not going to give you a no-trade clause. And I said, well, if I'm your first priority, I'd hate to see what your last one is. And so we went down to Atlanta, and as you know, we knocked the Pittsburgh Pirates out of it in 1991. We knocked them out of it in 1992. So I got my revenge. But this is the neat thing for my family and I. When we went back up to Pittsburgh for the first time after I left, I didn't play the game because they had a lefty throwing. So Brian Hunter was playing at first base, but in the last inning, we were getting killed 9-1. The Braves were getting killed in Pittsburgh. But Bobby Cox put me up in the last inning against Stan Belinda. He let me come out on the on-deck circle to pinch hit. And when they announced my name, the people in Pittsburgh stood up and gave me a 5-minute standing ovation. And I'm telling you, folks, I can get to be a softie. My eyes were watering. My knees were knocking as I went to got into the batter's box. And for somehow, if you know anything about baseball, you have to have your faculties. If you're not focused, if your concentration, if everything's not right with your body, you're not going to hit the pitch. But somehow, with my eyes watering and my knees knocking from the response of the crowd, Stan Belinda threw the pitch, and I proceeded to swing the bat, and I hit a home run over the center field wall. I can tell you, out of the 90 home runs that I hit in my career, that was the only one that I ever hit the dead center field, straight center field. All my other home runs were right center down the line or down the left field line. That was the only one that I ever hit the dead center field. And when I came around and I stepped on home plate again, the people of Pittsburgh once again gave me a 5-minute standing ovation. That meant a lot to my family and I. Those are great memories as far as baseball is concerned. And so those are just a couple things. Hopefully there was a little bit more in my 10-year career, but for time's sake, I'm going to move on and talk to you a little bit more about, you know, some of the same stuff that Crawford was talking about. Him and I have been meshing here today. I mean, I know Crawford, we didn't talk before we came down here, but it's kind of neat how, you know, his message and my messages are going to kind of go together, but I'm going to bring it from another twist. But I do want to share this with you real quick. I talked to you last night about some hobbies, and I have another hobby that happened during baseball time. And that hobby is I love to sleep. I mean, in baseball, you got to understand, when you go, you play your game, as soon as the game's over with, you know, you get something to eat, you go back to your room, and you wind down a little bit, and then you go to sleep. And you don't wake up till 12:30, 1 o'clock the next morning. And you get a shower, you go walk around the mall just a couple times, you get something to eat, and you're back at the ballpark by 2 o'clock, 2:30 on a road trip. And so you learn how to sleep very well. And all of us in here understand that sometimes when you sleep, you have dreams. Well, last night I had a dream that I was up in heaven with Peter. And everywhere I looked, there were clocks. And I said, Peter, I said, what are all these clocks for? And he said, Sid, he said, they're not clocks. He said, they're sin meters. And I said, sin meters? He said, yeah, every time somebody sins down on this earth, it registers up on one of these meters. And I said, man, that's new to me. So we walked a little bit, and I had to ask him. I said, well, Peter, could you tell me where my meter might be? And he said, yeah. He said, you're over there. You're not too bad. You're once every couple weeks. And I said, well, Peter, I'll keep on working to do better. And he said, that would be great. So we walked a little bit further, and being a concerned husband I am, I had to ask, well, could you tell me where my wife might be? And Peter said, well, she's over there. She's several times a day. She could be doing a lot better. And I said, well, that's partly my fault because I'm supposed to be the spiritual leader of the home. And I said, we'll keep on working on her as well. And he said, that would be super. But for some reason, and I know Crawford's not here to defend himself, But for some reason, Crawford Lurit's name came to my mind. And I said, well, Peter, could you tell me where Crawford's is? And Peter said, yeah, his is in the office. We use as a fan. But guys, what I want to share with you here this morning is the fact that, I mean, I love the outdoors. I am an avid bow hunter. And down here, I mean, I know, aren't we in the black belt right here of hunting? I mean, isn't this considered the black belt of hunting? I mean, I know that you got good deer down here. I know that you can take a deer a day or two deer a day or something like that. There's so many of them and so on and so forth. But I love the outdoors. And Lord, I mean, you know, right now in the fall, I'm looking forward to, I'll be going to Kansas and I'll be going to Iowa to do some bow hunting. I'm an avid bow hunter. But at the same time, I want you to understand that, you know, my excitement, and I mean, and if you're here today and if you enjoy the outdoors as well, most of us in here, that if you enjoy the outdoors, that excitement came from your dad. He grew up with it, you know, and brought it to him, and then I enjoyed, even before I had an opportunity to hunt, I enjoyed having my dad come home from that first day of rabbit and pheasant or that first day of deer season. You know, I know down here, I mean, see, up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, where I grew up, I should say, you know, when I was growing up, you had to be 12 years old and you had to take a test before you could go out and you could hunt. I know down here, I mean, if you're 2 years old and you can squeeze the trigger, you can go hunting. But up there, I mean, it was 12 years old, and my dad wouldn't let us go till 13 just to make sure that we were mature enough to be carrying a firearm. So I can remember it as a young boy, 5, 6 years old, and my dad would go off that first day of rabbit and pheasant hunting with all my uncles and my cousins and so on and so forth, and they would go off and they'd do their thing, and as my dad would come back and he'd pull up in front of our house, my first reaction as a young boy was I was running to the back porch. And I ran to the back porch, and eventually my dad would come out and he'd have his orange vest. And he'd take that orange vest and he'd put it down on the back porch. And as a young boy of 5, 6 years old, I can remember reaching down into that vest and pulling out a rabbit. And I'd hold their back legs of that rabbit, and my dad would sit there and skin that rabbit. And as a young boy, I'd sit there and say, man, this is awesome. This is so cool. I can't wait to go out and hunt. And as we go throughout that time frame of getting the rabbits clean, then I'd reach in and I'd pull out a pheasant or a rooster. And back then, I mean, it wasn't like you just plucked their breast off like you do a dove. You would put it in scalding hot water and you'd sit there, and then you'd sit there and pluck the feathers off of it. And again, as a young boy, I thought to myself, this is cool. Man, I can't wait for that opportunity to get out and do some hunting with my dad. And so that's where the love of hunting came from. You know, I read a lot of hunting stories. I love hunting stories. I wish I had, if you had any here today, I wish I had a chance to stand here and listen to them, because I love hunting stories. But at the same time, I mean, as I read a lot of hunting stories, generally that last paragraph that's in that hunting story, a lot of the time, the good percentage of the time, it would just say, I want to thank my dad for the opportunity that he gave me to teach me about hunting. And that's what I say about my dad. I thank my dad that he gave me that opportunity to understand all it was all about as far as hunting's concerned. So finally, I had the opportunity to go hunting. And I remember going out my first day, you know, of hunting season, and it was a blast. And as I went through those time frames, I mean, there were a lot of things that I learned from my dad. And one of the first things that I learned from my dad when I went out for the first time in rabbit hunting is I learned patience. And what I meant by that is, I mean, we had a dog named Snoopy. Snoopy was a great rabbit dog. He didn't listen a lick, but he was a great rabbit dog. And I'd be standing there, because as a young person, you had to be so many feet away from your parent or your guardian. And so I'd be standing there beside my dad, and Nobody knew where Snoopy was in this field. And that's, you know, so you'd hear this, here's Snoopy, here's Snoopy, Snoopy, here, here's Snoopy. No Snoopy anywhere. And then all of a sudden, about 100 yards out in front of us, you hear, oh, oh. And I look up at my dad, and I say, Dad, we got to go after the dog and eat the rabbit. He'd say, son, just sit right here. And so that dog would start to run that rabbit, and you hear this, oh, 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 oh. Dad, the rabbit's getting away. Son, just sit right here. And after a little bit, that dog would literally be out of earshot, and all of a sudden you'd start to hear, oh, 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 bang! I got you to jump right there. I saw you jumping. And my dad explained to me, son, if you're patient, that dog, and if that dog doesn't push that rabbit too hard, that rabbit's going to make a big circle and he's going to come right back to where he was before. And you're going to have a chance to shoot him if you're lined up the right place. And so I learned about patience. I learned from my dad all about gun safety. I learned where to, you know, he gave me the initial steps to me to understand where I needed to be standing during deer season so that I could have the best opportunity to be able to harvest the deer. I mean, with the lay of the land and how things were sloped and so on and so forth, my dad taught me that. My dad taught me how to string a, you know, put a worm on a string and be able to throw it out. I'm so thankful. I'm thankful to my dad for what he taught me as far as the outdoors, because I absolutely love being in God's creation. But you know something? I mean, as I went through my years and I started to hunt and I started to enjoy it more and more, and I started to reflect a little bit as far as all the things that my dad had taught me and all the fun that we were able to have, you know, some things started to come to my mind. And I started to reflect and I started to say, you know, my dad taught me these things, but there was a lot of other things that my dad taught me that he never opened his mouth about. And one of those guys is my dad never ever, you know, we had 6 kids in our family. He had 3 jobs at one point in time in order to put food on the table, but my dad never ever took more animals than what he was supposed to. He never took more than his 4 rabbits if he had that opportunity. He never took more than his 2 pheasants that he was supposed to. He never went out and poached a deer. My dad, another thing that I observed is my dad never ever went on somebody else's property without permission. I can remember in Pennsylvania, the rule was on the first day of deer season, and I want you to understand something. Up there, the first day of deer season, today even, you have Monday off after Thanksgiving in order to go deer hunting. And I can remember the first day being with my dad, standing beside my dad and having a buck out in front of us before it was time to hunt. And the rule was that you weren't even allowed to have your magazine or your gun loaded before it was time. And I can remember as a young boy sitting there and having a deer, a buck, standing out in front of us. And my dad would say, it's not time. It's not time. And that buck would walk through, never getting a shot. And as a young boy, can you imagine to me what I'm thinking to myself? Dad, we had an opportunity for a buck. But my dad understood, you got to follow the rules. I can remember the first day of fishing season. We'd go up to Laurel Lake. We'd have 2 boats. My uncle would have 1 boat, and then my other uncle and his family and my dad would have a boat. And we'd sit in that boat for the first day of trout season up there. And we'd go out and sit, and I don't know what time the thing started where you could throw out your line, But I can remember sitting there as a young boy before it became time, and I'd look over to my left 15 minutes before it was supposed to happen, and I'd see somebody throw their line in the water, and I'd look at my dad and say, "Dad, they're getting their line in the water. Can I get my line in the water?" And my dad would look at me and say, "Son, it's not time." And after about 5 or so minutes, I mean, I look over to my right and somebody's pulling out a trout, and I'd say, "Dad, they're catching all the fish." And my dad would once again tell me, "Sid, it's not time. We're not supposed to be fishing now." And when the time came, my dad would allow me to put my bait on my hook and throw it out into the water in order to start catching fish. But guys, I want you to understand something. I didn't understand it back then. But I'm so thankful that I had a dad. There was a man of ethics. There was a man of honor. There was a man of respect. Because that wasn't the way it was. I mean, when I went to this Safari Club International meeting one night, I was supposed to be going there to be able to speak on behalf of a group called Christian Sports International. And as I went to that meeting, you know, they had a row of kids in the front row. And they called in another president from another chapter that had it was a very successful chapter. And they asked him to get up and speak first. And so as he got up and spoke, the first words that came out of his mouth, like I said, with that row of kids in the front row, was this. He said, "Man, I was driving down the road the other day, and I looked up into this power line, and there stood a monster buck." He said, "I stopped, put my window down, I got my gun out the window, and I was just about ready to fire. And I looked in the rearview mirror, and here comes somebody behind me, and I was so ticked off, I had to put my gun down and lost a shot." And I'm saying, "Are you kidding me? You just told all these young kids it's okay to poach." And so I had my opportunity that night. But I didn't speak about Christian Sports International initially. I got up on the stage and I pointed my finger at the guy and I said, "Folks, this is exactly what we don't need as far as our hunting out in the hunting woods." I said, "He just told this whole group of kids right here it was okay to poach. He didn't like me. I didn't care." But folks, that's what we shouldn't, as dads, we got to be teaching our kids what is right. I went to speak in Erie, Pennsylvania years ago at a wild game dinner. And a gentleman come up after the dinner and he said, "I live on a steelhead fishing stream. And they run like salmon do. And every so often they run up their streams." And he said, "I mean, when they run, people just come onto my property without asking permission." He said, "But the bad part is, he said, "when they leave, I don't go out with a trash bag, but with trash bags to pick up the garbage that they've left behind." What are we teaching our kids? I have a friend down in Georgia, Northern Georgia, that's a DNR agent. He said that he could write a book, literally write a book on pastors that he has caught in the woods poaching or being on somebody else's property or stealing other people's possessions. What are we teaching our kids? My brother-in-law told me a story 2 years ago, how he was sitting in his camp and his nephew came back through the woods carrying a trail camera. And he said, "Where did you get that?" He said, "Well, I found it on a tree. Nobody is around, so I thought I could take it." My brother-in-law automatically said, "Are you crazy? Go put that thing back where you got it. Where did he get that from?" He didn't have a dad that told him what was right and what was wrong. Folks, the reason I'm sitting here today, I want to challenge you. Gilda Radner from Saturday Night Live told a story about her neighbor that had a golden retriever that was pregnant, and somehow as the neighbor was mowing his yard, that dog got its back legs caught in the mower. And they had to decide, what were they going to do? Were they going to euthanize the dog and try to save the puppies, or were they going to try to save the dog and see what happened with the puppies? They got to the place, folks, where they were going to try to save the dog and then see what happened with the puppies. So they had to amputate the back legs at the elbow of that dog. And as that dog started to get healthy and it started to be able to get around the house, the way that it would get around is it would lay on its brisket. It would bring its back legs up underneath itself and then reach out with its paws and just kind of get around the house that way. After so much time, that dog had its puppies, all of them healthy, all of them four legs. But you know how those puppies started to get around their house initially? They would get down under brisket, bring their back legs up underneath itself, and reach out with their paws. What is that telling us? Your kids, folks, are going to do what they see the parents do. And I want to ask you here tonight, or this morning, I should say, what are your kids seeing out of you? This isn't a huge spiritual aspect, but I'm asking you and I'm challenging you, what are your kids seeing out of you? Are your kids seeing you do the right thing? Are you being a great example? You have ethics and honor and integrity. Because I know that they don't do that, get that out into the world. You know, it used to be that Tim Tebow would be revered for his lifestyle. But now it's not Tim Tebow. They dismiss him in a heartbeat. They think of Lady Gaga and Ozzy Osbourne as being the hip things now. Something's wrong. Our political leaders, they need to be held to accountability. Folks, but it's not up to them. It's up to us as dads. It's up to us as grandparents to be able to teach our kids what is right and wrong. And my last thing that I'll just share with you, I mean, is this. You know, I the reason that I really and truly believe that my dad was a man of honor, was a man of integrity, and I'm not saying that you can't be that without Christ in your heart, but my dad loved Jesus. My grandparents on both sides loved Jesus, and they created a legacy for us of taking us to church on Sunday mornings, Sunday nights, and we heard the gospel. I didn't like it a lot of times. As a young boy, I hated sometimes, why do we got to be in church? We had a Christian singing group, a family Christian singing group to go all over Pennsylvania and sing, and I didn't like it. But today, I'm glad I did. I'm glad my mom and dad loved me enough to take me and to instill in me and to discipline me and make me into the man that I am today. I still mess up. I'm not perfect. I mess up all the time. But I'm grounded because I had a grandparents and I had a mom and dad that were willing to stand up and say the right things, to do the right things, to love me for who I was, and to teach me all about what Christ was about. And my challenge to you is here today, is that something that's important to you? My challenge to you today is to understand that there's a statistic out there that states if the mom is the one that brings the family up into the church and takes the kids to the church on a consistent basis, there's a 15% chance that those kids are going to follow in the mom's footsteps. But guys, as dads, if the dad's the leader of the home, if the dad's the one that takes charge and takes the family to the church, and he has a relationship with Jesus Christ and he's doing what he needs to do, there's a 70 to 75% chance that those kids are going to grow up and they're going to hold on to that faith that the dad had. So my challenge to you here tonight again, as I shared last night, is Christianity important to you that you're instilling that in your kids? Because that's the only way that things are going to change. I'm so thankful for Chris's kid and the other young man is down here. You know, I wish that I would have been that bold as a high school individual to go up to people and share my faith to them. And I meet kids when I go to FCA banquets and so on and so forth. And I sit there and I just marvel at their love for Jesus Christ. And I wish that I would have been able to be that bold back then. But the only way that that happens, folks, is because of dads and moms. And specifically you guys that stands up and you make the challenge of being who you need to be to your kids. If you didn't have that growing up, if you didn't have that dad, you need to break the chain. And you got to start a legacy right now that's going to change the outcome of your family. You need to love that family. You need to love that wife. You need to love those children the way that Christ told us to love them. And you need to start making a change in your life so that they might understand that I'm a man of God. And so that's my challenge to you here today. Not a lot of biblical stuff, but guys, we need to see things change. And the only way that's going to happen is if you get on your knees on a daily basis and you say, Lord, make me into the man of God that you want me to be. Help me to love my wife. Help me to love my kids. And help me to show them Jesus. Help me to be a man of honor. Help me to be a man of integrity. Help me to be a man of respect. And let's see what happens. And see whether or not God doesn't honor that prayer. And bring your kids to the place where they bow on their knees and they say, Lord, I need you. Because, guys, that's where peace comes from. I have 4 children. Every one of my children, guys, knows Jesus Christ as their Lord and Savior. No hesitancy. My kids send me devotionals. And you know what that does for me? It allows me to put my head on a pillow at night and sleep peacefully. Because I know that if something happened to me or something happened to them, I'm going to see them again. Is that the case with you? As I told you last night, my nephew, I hope and pray, and at 8 or 9 years old, he supposedly gave his life to Jesus Christ. But there's been no fruit. There's been nothing signifying that he gave his heart to Jesus Christ at that time frame. And to think, you know, I'm not a judge, but to think that Danny could be in hell today, not just for a temporary time, folks, but for eternity. It hurts me. It hurts me big time. So I challenge you men here today. I challenge you as grandparents. I challenge you to get on your knees and ask God to make you into the men of God that you need to be in your household and in your workplace, okay? God bless you. Let's have a word of prayer, and I'm going to get moving.